in the state of Oregon?
Well, first of all, I guess the non-black type is existing law, and I haven't thought too much about the question that you were raising, but I guess it would mean that a non-Oregon savings and loan, be it Utah, we'll use Utah as our example. First of all, they can't transact business in this state in the savings and loan sense unless they get a license from Mr. Hess to be able to do so. Now, they can make loans in the state if they don't have offices and so on here, because there's certain other provisions that we have in the code that says in order to attract money that outside foreign people can come in and use their money to make loans within the state if they don't have offices, they don't have employees, and they don't have other people doing that. They can make their money available or buy loans or originate loans without being considered to transact business. And I think transact business here is one that refers to taking deposits and putting up some mortar and brick and putting a sign up on the wall that says that we're here doing business. It's more than just making loans. Part of it, but it's more than doing that.
So it would be based on if this were the situation that if the home base of that savings and loan association, for instance, were in Utah and Utah was not cooperative in terms of Oregon participating in business in their state, that we could prevent them from putting a branch office, for instance, in Portland.
Yes.
Okay.
Assuming they're not grandfathered in or there isn't some other provision. The matter came up with one of the associations now. It's been consummated since then, but it came up at the time when Utah Association was going to acquire an Oregon Association, which they have done since then. And at the same time that we were turned down to get a branch in Ogden, we had applied for it, and they hadn't bothered to let any foreign associations in. Subsequently, that's been changed, and we have been admitted in the state of Utah. But there could be some other states where that would come up, and the feeling is that we want our regulators to be able to look beyond just the mere statute to how the administrators administer that statute, and that's the purpose of the changes that would be.
Wouldn't prevent a very wealthy banking type from Utah from purchasing a very large savings and loan chain in Oregon, huh? Like Fred Meyer?
Well, let me say the very wealthy banking type in Utah that purchased that isn't in Utah. He's New York or whatever else. Now, ultimately, it may get put together with a association that the wealthy individual owns and has control of in the state of Utah on that. This would not prevent that, because that's an Oregon chartered association doing that. But the one we had before was the same people involved, was American in with Willamette. And they there, now the Willamette Savings and Loan is a branch of American Savings and Loan of Salt Lake City.
In the case that I was just making reference to, then there would be nothing to prevent a savings and loan association purchasing out an Oregon savings and loan association, even though the state of Utah might not allow the participation we would like to see. It wouldn't prevent that?
Well, there is a provision, to go back, there are other provisions not affected by this part of the code so much getting involved. It says if somebody's going to get control of an Oregon association, they have to file certain information and get the approval of the state savings and loan supervisor. And so I don't care if they're individuals or whatever, can come in and acquire an Oregon association without going through some filings and getting the approval of the state savings and loan supervisor. Isn't that right, Mr. Hess? And
so, but taking that into consideration, would Section 26 impact that kind of a sale?
No. I would say Section 26 would not impact the question of whether some person is eligible or qualified or the kind of a person that you want meets the criteria to acquire an association. By and large, Section 26 is concerned with whether you're going to let an association in its own name operate across state lines, and that's the guts of that one. And the other sections really relate to the questions that.
But they could solve the problem by buying out an Oregon savings and loan, and they'd reach the.
But they have to have approval of the savings and loans. And as a practical matter, to do all these things, because all these are insured associations, they also have to have approval of this Federal Home Loan Bank that I referred to back there. So it isn't quite as easy as going in and snapping.
I wasn't talking about the process of being able to do it. I was talking about the impact of that provision.
There are other sections that says if you're going to get control of an Oregon association, or even before you get control, you get more than if you just came out and wanted to acquire more than, you didn't have any interest at all in association, you wanted to acquire more than 10% of an Oregon association, you're going to buy the stock and you're going to get more than 10%, prior to being able to do that, you have to file with the supervisor and get their approval. And if you're part of the mafia or whatever else, he has some grounds that he can disapprove that.
Or she can disapprove that.
If it's all right with Mr. Love, I'd like to move this bill to the floor.
No question.
It's all right with me.
I'll move A. Engross Senate Bill 849 as amended today to the floor, do pass.
Okay. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Slattery, DeBoer,
Gilpin,
aye.
Markham,
aye.
Parkinson,
aye.
Mr.
Chairman,
aye.
Okay.
Thank you. We have before us now Senate Bill 879.
You want to carry this paper?
Senator Brown is here.
Which one? 879.
Brown. Yeah, 879.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for letting me brief you on this bill. If you take a look at the bill, you'll see that it was introduced by a number of members of the Senate at the request of the Oregon Memorial Association. And maybe the first question is, who is the Oregon Memorial Association? There is around the country a number of, let's say, consumer groups that have through the years been concerned with the high cost of dying. And if you go, for example, into Yamhill County, you find that Senator McMinnville is something known as the Yamhill County Memorial Service Association, which has been there 100 years, concerned with the problems of the high cost of dying and trying to approach this necessary but not always a pleasant problem. At the Oregon level, we have the Oregon Statewide Organization of Consumers concerned with funeral arrangements, is known as the Oregon Memorial Association. And at the national level, it's called the Continental Association of Funeral and Memorial Societies. Well, I was asked to introduce for the Oregon Memorial Association this bill. And if you take a look at it, you'll see it really just does two things. First of all, it makes those professionals, those men and women in the state who are only licensed funeral directors but who are not licensed embalmers, have a shot at a seat on the State Board of Funeral Directors and Embalmers. At the present time, you have to be an embalmer in order to be eligible for a seat. There are a number of individuals who have dual license. They are, on one hand, a licensed embalmer, and they are, on the other hand, a licensed funeral director. But there are a very sizable number of funeral directors in the state who are strictly businessmen and businesswomen who are precluded from having membership. Secondly, there has always been, at least in recent years, an opportunity for two of the seven members to be represent the public. But we felt it appropriate to specify that one of those members be from a recognized consumer organization. Now, obviously, the Oregon Memorial Association would like to have the governor nominate a member from their group, but it could come from the Oregon Consumer League or the National Association of Retired Teachers, or it could come from the National Federation of Retired Federal Employees or from the American Association of Retired People. Any retired aging group who are concerned with this problem. And the language recognized consumer organization I took out of a bill that we passed back in 1975 dealing with the membership on the Oregon Blind Commission. The only change that was made in the Senate Business and Consumer Affairs Committee was to say, rather than the board having three embalmers, two funeral directors, and two public members, the board should simply have five members who would come from either the embalming profession or from the funeral director profession, and there would not be a requirement for dual membership.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Are there any people in opposition of this bill?
Not here, not that I know. It passed with one negative vote out of the committee. We have two gentlemen here. One is a constituent in my district who has a he's the president of a mortuary in the Hollywood District of Portland, and another man is the senior executive officer of a large chain around the state.
Yeah, I see on our sign-up sheet that we are in favor of the bill, so
yes.
If you have any objections, we want to move the bill out.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
you have written statements before you, by the way, from the other two gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Joe French, the lobbyist for the association statewide, also is in support of the bill.
Okay. Well, Chairman, I'll move A and Gross Senate Bill 879 to the floor. Do pass.
Okay. Discussion. Clerk, call
the
roll.
No opposition.
Bradbury.
Aye.
DeMore.
Aye.
Markham.
Aye.
Parkinson. Roberts.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Motion passed.
The agenda will be
here. I hope I didn't disappoint you, Senator Brown, and the gentleman there, because we like to do business fast here.
Yes, we appreciate it. They had an exercise of two written statements and coming down here to see how we do things.
Thank you. Brown is also the minister.
Senator Brown, are you still here?
I'm still here.
We have before us now Senate Bill 885.
I would like, Mr. Chairman, if you could bring up, sit beside me here, Ross Laburn, an attorney who is the chief counsel for the Consumer Protection Division of the Oregon Department of Justice.
Yeah.
And the background of this bill was that at the time that we had all of the activity and concerns about pyramid investing, I checked with the Consumer Protection Division, and they felt that a clarification of the law was necessary so that lawyers and laymen alike knew exactly where they stand. And with that, I would like to ask Mr. Laburn if he would maybe give you more details.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know from my testimony before this committee earlier in the session, our office is responsible, along with the district attorneys, for enforcement of the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And one of those provisions is a provision prohibiting the operation and the promotion of pyramid clubs in the state. And that provision was added to the statute in 1973. Now, a pyramid is generally characterized, I guess, by beyond what it says in the statute, in layman's terms, by the fact that it's really not a legitimate business, in the sense that it's not in business for the sale of goods or services to retail customers. It's in the really an organization which its sole function is to recruit other people to invest, in order to recruit other people to invest in the organization in perpetuity, hopefully. Of course, as a practical matter, they all come to an end somewhere down the line. In the last couple of years, there are many different types of pyramids. We have seen, in particular, in the state of Oregon, a variety that is really akin to what are known as chain letter schemes. And that has been the primary pyramid club to operate in the state of Oregon in the last couple of years. They are, in my estimation, a classic pyramid scheme. It meets the definitions both of the statute and of the general ones I've laid out for you. The ones that have operated here in the state in the past couple of years have required anywhere from a $100 investment to a $5,000 investment to essentially play the game. The argument that was initially made by those proponents of those schemes was generally along the lines that, well, hopefully or maybe they weren't pyramid clubs, because you see they are chain letters, and nowhere in ORS 646609 is there the phrase chain letter. And certainly that is the case. However, my office reviewed the legislative history on the statute, reviewed the case law regarding similar statutes in other states, and the case law in general on pyramid clubs, lotteries, and chain letters. We came to the conclusion that 609 applied to those types of schemes, that it was a classic pyramid club, and there was no reason why a chain letter should not fit within it. On that basis, we filed approximately 8 lawsuits over the past couple of years against promoters of those schemes. To date, Several are settled, several are pending, and one, only one, to date was tried, and the trial court found that the chain letter scheme was in fact in violation of ORS 646609. Therefore, as Senator Brown said, we believe the statute does apply to those schemes, and we view this particular amendment to that statute as purely one of clarifying for particularly the public the fact that these chain letter schemes are pyramid clubs and that you're essentially engaging in illegal activity if you engage in the promotion of them. Now, having said that, I would make one final footnote, and that is that that, of course, is subject to any change in the law by the courts. The one case that we were successful in, one of the defendants has filed a notice of appeal, and so it appears that the case will go up on appeal. We don't yet know what the issues will be and certainly don't know how they'll be decided. But at least in our opinion, as of today, this particular amendment to the statute would not really be a substantive change. It would be one merely of clarification of the statute.
Ross, what other pyramid clubs do you have besides the chain letters?
When the bill was first passed, some pyramid clubs have the sale of a good or a product associated with them. The I don't know if you're familiar, but back in the early 70s, there were Glenn Turner, who became quite famous across the country, had a scheme called Dare to be Great, and it was the classic at that time pyramid club. And it did involve that you would get something back. You got some promotional tapes for your money. But the bottom line in the scheme was essentially what I've described before, that you couldn't really make any significant amount of money by continuing to sell these tapes. The way you made your money was to get more people involved who would pay the $5,000.
Okay. So, Senator Thomas?
There was a cleaning... sold cleaning products of some kind that was involved in a state a few years ago. The current situation that's going on in East Multnomah County with the pyramid things, those involve, as I understand it, only an investment of dollars, and they're done on the pyramid basis. Can you speak to that situation out there?
I am not acquainted with the exact facts other than what I've picked up in a couple of the newspaper articles, and my understanding was that the scheme out there was the one that I'm talking about that was popular in the last couple of years, purely a chain letter scheme. You put your name on a list, and I don't think there was any product or
I don't even think there was a letter.
That's possible.
There was not even the letter as the front, I understand, in that situation out there.
Some of the there are so many myths about, you know, in so many ways people look to find some loophole in the law and some notion that they may be legal. A lot of times we had people say to us, well, chain letters we know are illegal, but as you were just describing, there is no letter. We put the money in envelopes, and because there's no letter and we keep a master list someplace, therefore it's legal. And it's really unfortunate the myths that grow up around these types of schemes.
Well, I Mr. Chairman, I'm really concerned about the one out there, because at the current time there's two superintendents of East County school districts who are involved, and I understand there are going to be several more before the month is out, and it went right through the school systems out there among, you know, what you think of as sort of educated, responsible people, and they really believed, well, they said they believed they were not acting outside of the law. And clearly, by this definition, they were. And I'd be happy to see it clarified. I hope this clarifies it more. I'm not even sure it goes as far as I'd like to see it in terms of making... I don't know how you clarify it further, but it seems to me there's a real question there. These people are believing they're investing. And I think this is just different than investment, and I'm not sure why that distinction is so difficult.
I'm not sure either, Representative Roberts. I'm afraid that there is no amendment that we can make to the statute which will completely satisfy, because, like I say, it is amazing the explanations that you get. Once upon a time, another explanation we got was that if you didn't put a return address on your letter when you mailed it, that it was not a chain letter. Somehow it was only a chain letter if your name was on the envelope.
They're ready to go. The train is about to leave.
You like a motion?
Yeah. One question. Do you want an emergency clause on it or what?
Well, I don't, like I say, I don't believe because, you know, in my view, it's not a substantive change. I don't think it's necessary.
Chairman, I'll move Senate Bill 885 to the floor do pass.
Discussion?
Clerk, call roll.
Representative Bradbury, Moore, Dolan, Markham.
Aye.
Parkinson.
Aye.
Let me ask, excuse me.
Let's say you have
a... Got to call the roll.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye. Motion
passed. Let me ask this gentleman a question before he leaves. Do you get involved in the policing of the bingo games?
No, we don't. That's not within the unlawful trade practice.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to do business with this committee. If you have any vacant seats over here, let me know.
Will you go back and say how easy we are?
It's a pleasure to have you, Senator Brown.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 708.
Does that throw up?
Yes. Very thankful, Mr. Vice Chair. Mr. Bassinet.
Tom.
Ride your bicycle up here, or motorcycle up here.
Isn't this Brown's bill, too?
Oh, tried to race me the other morning. I was on my bicycle, though.
Yeah, you have your helmet on?
Of course not.
Is this another helmet law?
Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I'm Tom Bessonet, assistant to the president of Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. I appreciate the speed with which we are beginning to hear Senate Bill 708. I'd like to give you just a little bit of background. I realize that maybe some of you are well aware of what has happened, but in 1971, under the tutorship of then Insurance Commissioner Corny Bateson, Oregon adopted what was considered to be its modification of the no-fault concept. Mm-hmm. No-fault was a very much kicked around idea. Basically, it was trying to do a couple of things. One, insist that the people who were injured be paid immediately without delay and irrespective of who was at fault for the accident. In the course of no-fault, you surrendered your right of suing the wrongdoer. And so Oregon adopted what we call the modified no-fault or
excuse me, Tom.
May I interrupt this moment? Yes. I want to make sure that Fred looks right for the camera and he's posing.
He always looks right.
We'll check it out. now he's not going to be comfortable with the old gene.
Let's see. Oh, yes, no fault. And as a result, the law was passed in 1971 and has been a model for many of the other states to look at because it called for immediate payment to the injured party, irrespective of fault within your own car, and then you had the right of suit against any of the wrongdoers, so you had the best of both worlds. That law stayed on the books for a long time without any challenge and worked very well with very little modification. However, in 1979, some sharp young attorney, or sharp attorney, I don't know whether he was young or not, challenged, younger than I was anyway, challenged some language of the 1971 Act. And actually, the language, if you look at B and Gross, is contained in line 7 and 8 on page 1. Says injured in a motor vehicle accident. As you'll notice in line 6, it says bracketed material other than moped or motorcycles. Well, the 1971 Act said that any personal automobile had to be insured for personal injury protection, which is medical insurance, income continuation, essential services, and funeral expenses. And any car that had liability insurance had to have personal injury protection insurance at the same time. We couldn't write it without combining the two together, except on motorcycles. On motorcycles and mopeds, we did not have to write PIP, or personal injury protection. We had to write the liability only. The attorney had a client who was injured in a motor vehicle accident, and his father had an automobile insured for PIP insurance. And he said, well, look, the law says that anyone injured in the members of the person's family residing in the same household injured in a motor vehicle accident, and since he was involved in a motor vehicle accident, the motorcycle, that he was entitled to payment even though we were not selling insurance on that motorcycle. And the Court of Appeals said that's right. The Supreme Court of Oregon said that's right. And so from 1979 on, if you had an automobile that had PIP insurance and you had a motorcycle that did not have any insurance or did not have PIP insurance and you were injured in a motor vehicle accident on your motorcycle, you in fact did have coverage. Although the 1971 legislature, the 1975 legislature, the 1979 legislature, which modified it, always exempted motorcycles. But the Supreme Court said because of the language of the law, even though the policy specifically excluded motorcycles, still the law said motor vehicle accident.
Is that what you call being hooked with adverse selection that I keep hearing about?
No, as I said, I think that was a very sharp attorney.
You're forced to cover something that you don't contract for.
Yes. It was an extension of coverage that we did not anticipate. We had thought that even if, with the language of other than motorcycle, that we were okay. So what Frank Howlett and I did then is that, and the Interim Committee, by the way, on Judiciary, studied in depth whether or not they should mandate PIP insurance on motorcycles. And the Committee on Insurance and Banking and Retirement in the Senate has a bill that mandates motorcycle insurance, or PIP. It's Senate Bill 30. There is a tremendous amount of opposition to that concept because that insurance premium is extremely high because of the need of it is great. And so, therefore, the committee over there is not acting on that bill. Instead, they did want to modify the what we call Garrow decision, or the decision that made the automobile insurance companies pay for the motorcyclists. This bill, 708, modifies the language so that we clarify that it was never the intent of the PIP law to cover motorcycles or their injuries if they have not purchased PIP insurance. Many of them do, in fact, buy PIP insurance on motorcycles, and therefore they are covered. And that's the whole purpose of this particular piece of legislation.
Say a family has a youngster that has a motorcycle. How do they, at a reasonable price, insure it?
They don't?
For liability. Let's assume now that we're talking about a family that has several automobiles, mm-hmm. one or two automobiles, they're already insured in a major line insurance company in the state of Oregon, and the young person has a motorcycle, as long as it's a rather small motorcycle. I mean, I'm not talking about the biggies, the 750 cc's or whatever they might be, but as long as we're talking about a moderate sized motorcycle, the liability insurance will cost them about $40 for 6 months. And you can add PIP insurance, or the personal injury protection, to that through the auto insurance policy on most of the companies. Now, if you have somebody who is a motorcyclist and that's all he has is just one motorcycle, he has a little bit more difficulty because he does not have other insurance to go with that, so he goes into what we call the specialty market, or Elite Insurance Company, or Dairyland Insurance Company, which specializes in insuring motorcycles. They will write him his insurance liability-wise for, again, depending upon the size of the engine. And then, as a result of that, they can add, if they want to, medical insurance, but not PIP insurance. It would not continue the wage loss, as an example. So there is a market available for the average family with motorcycles.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Bassinet, do you leave it as an underwriting decision to make any difference between on-road or off-road use or any of that? As far as you're concerned, it's just the personal injury protection, and that's all you're concerned about. Is there any difference between, a dirt bike?
The dirt bike normally does not carry any insurance at all, liability or otherwise, because they are out in the boondocks and they don't carry any kind of insurance on it.
Okay.
And the one exclusion by statute that affects it is that if you're riding an unlicensed, unregistered vehicle, as I recall, and if they're in a race or preparing for a race, the trail riding type deal. Now, there, other than correcting modifying the decision of the Supreme Court of Oregon, there is one other substantial change, and that's contained in page 3. On line 11, in the middle of the line, we have added the words aggregate of 52 weeks. And that same change is down in line 18. Some of the insurance companies, in the past, it has said a payment for 52 weeks. Some of the insurance companies have been interpreting that to mean that it applied for 1 year from the date of the accident. And if you were totally disabled from that period on, that would be all right. But the intent of the legislation was that if a person was injured and was off work for 2 weeks, or maybe 3 months, we'll say, and then attempted to go back to work and worked for a month with interruption, attempting to restore themselves back to the normal, and then had to go back to disability, that time would have been lost. That month in there would have been lost, and they would have only paid for 1 year from the date of the accident. We're making it very clear that we intend that this to be the aggregate of 52 weeks. If it takes 3 years to do it or 5 years to accumulate 52 weeks of payment, that's okay. That's what the law intended it to be.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question? When Frank got hurt last year in his accident and went through some hospitalization and surgeries and then went a period of time and went back to work, and then after that period of time had an additional surgery, and then was off again for a period of time from that additional surgery, it would have removed that centerpiece of time, and you